So, yesterday, in the synagogue, they read the parsha. It starts off with perhaps the most bizarre, peculiar, intriguing, compelling, interesting mitzvah of all. That is the mitzvah of the red heifer, the red cow. And let's give quickly the outline, the details of what this mitzvah is. So we know in the times of the temple that existed for 800 years, and even before that, before the temple, so essentially from the times of Moses until the destruction of the second temple in the year 70 on the hands of Titus and the Romans, the Jewish people had a certain degree of sanctity assigned to this one locale or one center point of the nation. And that was either the tabernacle, this portable house of worship, which was eventually, under the leadership of Solomon, that was made permanent on Temple Mount. Thus, for about 1,500 years, a little less, I'd say 1,400 years, we have the epicenter of Jewish life, the epicenter of Jewish, observance, and the center point of Jewish spirituality is in this locale. And the idea behind it, obviously, is that there is some sort of physical representation of spirituality. And that's kind of the Jewish idea. The Jewish innovation, perhaps above all, is where we can engage in physical activities, or at least on the surface to be physical, but we uplift it and give it a spiritual realm, a spiritual value as well. Thus, you go to the temple, you bring your animal, and they sacrifice the animal, and you eat a steak, and that's a mitzvah. And if you look at the steak, and you just take a picture of it and put it posted on Instagram, as the kids do today, or Snapchat, right? If you just look at the steak on its own, it doesn't seem to be very spiritual. It seems to be perhaps very...
It's yours.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
But I don't want you to know.
It seems very, it's food. It seems maybe perhaps very succulent and very sizzling, but it's food. It's not anything spiritual, but this is a spiritual activity. And that's kind of the Jewish innovation, whereas we take the physical, we uplift it. Thus, the temple, if you looked at it, just took a picture, it looks like a really nice house, some really nice vessels, lots of gold and whatever. But this is a spiritual location. And these concurrent coexisting realities where we have a physical representation, but everything has a spiritual component, that is maybe one of the core Jewish ideas. Now, part of part of the laws governing this whole realm of the temple and the sanctity is the idea of purity and impurity. Now, I want to just preface that these are very, very hard things for us to understand. What does it mean, purity? What does it mean, ritual purity? What does it mean, spiritual? What does impurity mean? Why, if someone is in a hospital and someone else dies in the same hospital on a different ward, on a different floor, on a different, essentially, you have no contact with them. Why would someone, because they're in the same enclosure, become impure? That's a bizarre idea to us. But it's I like to liken it to the idea of a certain bacteria, spiritual bacteria that just you can't see it, it's not something you could see, but we get the same, it's basically the same thing. It's something which is transmittable to someone that you come in contact with and you can't see it. Thus, there's this idea of if you're in a room with a dead body, the Torah says you're impure. No, does that mean that you're dirty? No. Does that mean that you're ill? No. Does that mean that you're bad? Also not. If Moses was in a room with a dead body, he too becomes impure, and he too is not allowed to walk into the temple. It's not about how special you are, or how good you are, or what decisions you made. It's just the reality. If you come in contact with that person, you cannot walk into the temple. Not only that, you cannot walk into the temple. You cannot eat any sacrifices. Now, I want to mention this again. This is something which is we're going to have to transition into the thinking that there's something that we cannot see that is at play. And I would even venture to say that something we cannot even grasp that much or understand that clearly, that is really governing these laws. And that's going to get worse. just the thought of not understanding is going to deepen in the course of this conversation. Okay, so that's the idea. So we have the idea of purity. If you want to go into the temple, you want to eat the sacrifices, you have to be pure. There are certain things that you could do to make you impure, certain things you touch, especially if you touch a dead body or you're in a room with a dead body, or you go to a cemetery, right? Then you would have to purify yourself before you walk into the temple or eat temple foods. Okay? So now let's say we all came in contact with dead people. And in fact, we all did. Because if you were in a hospital, you know, or if you were in a cemetery, or if, you know, you went to a funeral, exactly. Well, a funeral, you might be able to avoid it if you're not exactly touching the bier.
What is that?
The coffin. Yeah, or if it's an outdoor funeral or whatever.
So if you just participate in a funeral procession,
you're not impure. That's right.
Then how can it be that if you are in the hospital and somebody dies, you could be impure, you didn't touch them either?
Because there's an enclosure. The building is the enclosure, and the very complex laws of how purity gets transmitted, and how if it was all hermetically sealed, then it would be different. But because it's not, and it doesn't matter how big the hospital is, it doesn't matter if you're in a small room or in an enormous, cavernous auditorium, or if you're in a hospital, so long as it's all connected,
so
it's all one enclosure.
So a person who visits the hospital on a daily basis is daily impure.
Yeah, well, once you're impure, you're impure. It's just a status.
All
of us are impure. Every single human
today.
But Kohen
not going to a cemetery.
Yeah, so the Kohen, for the Kohen, it's something different. The Kohen has a mitzvah to not become impure. For us, we have no mitzvah not to become impure. We could walk in the cemeteries all day and all night. You know, we could go slather ourselves, in a cemetery, you know.
Kohen is a priest.
That's right, that's right. For us, there's no problem, because we have no plans of going to the temple. There's no temple around. We have no sacrifices that we need to do. We're good to go. We're not prohibited to become impure. It doesn't really matter for us. However, for the Kohen, there's a mitzvah, a prohibition in the Torah, for them not to come into contact with dead people. That's why, for a Kohen, especially in Israel, they don't go into hospitals that often. Now, why I say especially in Israel? Because the only impurity is where there's a Jewish person, a dead Jewish cadaver, as opposed to, well, non-Jews as well, but to a lesser extent. Thus, in Israel, what Kohens usually you don't venture into hospitals that often. Now, if you ever go to a Jewish cemetery, especially in Israel, you'll notice that there's going to be dividers. There's going to be pathways, and then there's going to be dividers. And if you look at the names of all the gravestones on the margins, on the edges, near the pathways, they'll all be Cohen, Kaplan, Rappaport, all these Cohen names. HaKohen, HaKohen, HaKohen. The reason is because a Cohen is allowed to go to the cemetery, provided that he is, by the laws of purity, separated. So if you have a 40-inch fence that separates you and the graves, well, you're separate. Thus, they make it convenient for Kohens to go visit their loved ones in the cemetery because they put them right next to the borders, and they can walk right there, and you know, just like anyone else. Yeah, and I say, actually, interestingly, I remember when I was yeshiva in Israel, so they had two buildings next to each other, across the street from each other, but they were connected via an underground tunnel because they had like dining rooms in both locations. But there was only a kitchen in one, thus they would transfer the food via this underground passage. But I remember once when one of the heads of the institution passed away, so they were doing the funeral, and the eulogies were in the base medrash, in the study house. They had the corpse was there. So they had signs at all the doors, if you're a Kohen, don't walk in. And in fact, even the building across the street, because it's connected via the underground channel, Kohen cannot walk into. So if you have a dormitory in the other building, you gotta stay out and, I don't know, buy falafel or whatever, but you can't walk in there.
So they couldn't participate in the service?
Well, they could be outside.
Yeah, but not present.
That's right, they can't be inside.
But that's only as long as the body's there. Once the body
goes out. Oh, yeah, once the body goes out, it's fine. Yeah, that's right.
So the building, the inanimate object, cannot become impure, even though it came in contact with.
Not with exactly, because the buildings anyhow not going to the temple, right? But yes, that would be true. I think there are some instances like the laws of Taras, where there's some sort of infection that could take on someone's skin or clothing or house. That might be the one exception where an inanimate object who could receive some degree of impurity.
And this only relates to men, not the wife of.
Because the Kohen, right, the Kohen females can become impure, but then they would have a problem if they want to eat truma, which is the Kohen food. Yeah.
So in other words, I know right, I go from a line of Kohens on my mother and father's side. Okay.
Okay.
Would I then?
No problem. You could go to a cemetery, go to a funeral, no problem. And in fact, even a Kohen is allowed to go to a funeral and become impure for seven relatives. Right? Father, mother, sister, brother, wife, son, daughter. That's all the closest relationships they're allowed to go, with the exception of the high priest. The high priest doesn't make himself impure for no one. Right? Not father, not spouse, not nothing. But all the other Kohens, their closest relatives, they can, by Torah law, that's an exception to the prohibition of them becoming impure, that they're allowed to intentionally, deliberately make themselves impure by going, participating in the funeral, etc.
Once you're impure, can you become pure again?
That's the question. So let's say you're impure, all of us are impure, what do we do? So that's what the Torah discusses in this passage, Parsha. And it tells us that we take a red cow, and we take it, and it has to be a perfectly red cow. It's got no black hairs, no white hairs. It's never been used to work the fields. And by the way, the red cows exist. There's a whole lot of them out there. There's an entire species of red cows. It's actually burnt orange, the actual color. And the only difference is the only thing that makes this one special is that it's perfectly. It's got no black hairs, no white hairs, and was never used for work. And you take it outside Jerusalem. You slaughter it. You make a massive fire. You burn the entire cow, enormous cow. You put into the cow, other thing, into the fire, some wood from a cedar tree, some grasses, some worms, some other stuff. And then and when it's all finished burning, you have a mountain of ashes. You take the ashes, you mix it with some water. You take the whatever potion is created. You take someone who is pure. And then he sprinkles on the people that is not pure on the third day and on the seventh day. And then they become pure.
So it's a massive hassle, right?
It's a huge hassle.
That's why they would rather stay away from the funerals and hospitals, right?
But remember, for this, it's also for Jews, for regular Jews, regular Israelites.
Yeah.
Right. This was a massive, very common practice that happened during the times of the temple. You would go, and they would use a tiny little bit, because it's a very precious, very expensive to buy the red cow that's perfect. It's a very rare phenomenon. You take a tiny little bit, you give a little tiny sprinkle of this potion, and you're good to go.
So it's not like one cow per one ritual.
Oh, no. Yeah, take a tiny bit. Exactly, yes.
Basically, save the ashes.
Oh, yeah, they save it. And they use a tiny, 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 tiny little bit.
So what was it? They would sell it at like some ancient pharmacies or something?
No, they would do it in Jerusalem. I'm sure there was like a station, like a washing station, you know, before everyone gets in there.
So who owned the ashes? Who dispensed the ashes?
Probably the offices of the temple, I would assume. They had the coffers of the temple. They were donations every year. People would give donations, a shekel. That's how they would make a census. They wouldn't count the people. They would count the coins that people would give. But then anyone who wanted to give anything, Jews, non-Jews alike, everyone could donate to the temple whatever they wanted. There was, like I said, there was the annual census of the people, but the annual gift was one half shekel coin, which is actually not very expensive. So it was rich people, poor people alike. But besides for that, it was on a donation. That's how they fundraise, the only donation system.
Just like a bull tax.
Well, it wasn't a tax. But, you know, they had to buy wood, and there were daily sacrifices, and there were maintenance, and this and that. But it wasn't so much. The biggest fundraising was done in the Torah, actually, where they had to actually build it all for the first time. You know, so you had to build a menorah, which is built, chiseled out of solid gold, an enormous block of solid gold.
So
yet. So that's that
the Romans had stolen.
Oh yeah, well, that's a matter of tremendous intrigue. Because we know on the Arch of Titus, the aforementioned Titus, they have this picture of them carrying this massive menorah, which, by the way, is the symbol of the state of Israel, that same menorah. But it seems very likely that that's not the same menorah. Firstly, because on the bottom, the base of that menorah, there's these symbols. And we know symbols in Judaism don't go so well. The idea of putting images on sacred items is sacrilegious, because we don't believe in imagery. You know, imagery is always associated with idolatry in Jewish thought. Plus, even if they did take it, where is it now? We don't know, because Rome was sacked in the 5th century. So
probably melted it to build the amphitheater.
In all likelihood, that's not the right menorah. Anyhow, it's possible that there were multiple menorahs. That's one theory, is that there were multiple menorahs. Another theory is that this was just like a stand-in. They archived the real menorah and they just put this one in instead. But then there's other thing, the Ark of the Covenant. It's this box made out of solid gold. It's interestingly that the menorah, the candelabra, the menorah, that one was till the end of the Second Temple era. As opposed to the Aron, the ark, that disappeared after the First Temple era. That's when the Babylonians came. It was already gone. It seems likely that the king at the time, Josiah, he probably archived it, put it somewhere. There is this one narrative in the Talmud that there was one Kohen who found it. Either they didn't tell people about it, or they told people, but then they died, whatever. It's not clear where it is. But those things are very expensive. So how'd they do that? That they get gold, and that everyone had to sponsor, everyone had to contribute towards that. And you know, that was the major fundraising efforts. But besides for that, you know, once it's all built, you know, actually, the Mishnah does tell these great stories of some individuals who upgraded, you know, who did efforts to upgrade the facilities. Like there was a kior. A kior is this water basin made out of copper that the Kohens would wash their hands in, you know, because it's a lot of hand washing, feet washing, etc., before they walk in. And it had only 2 spigots. And then one guy came and said, oh, I'm going to add 12 spigots to make it easier so the Kohens have to wait in line to wash their hands. You know, and he's mentioned for eternity in praise that he contributed, you know, towards refurbishing the temple. Then there's another guy who invested tons of money and went to Alexandria in Egypt, and he bought these massive doors, and he swapped out the wooden doors and put in massive copper doors, and it's called Shar Nicanor, the Nicanor Gate, after this guy Nicanor, who invested money into upgrading the temple. But those are periodic upgrades.
So it would be like Bill Gates, Solomon.
Well,
like
no,
museum,
no,
right?
But they did that. Like the that gate is forever called Shar Nicanor, Nicanor Gate, because he upgraded to these massive copper doors.
And they had good contractors in ancient
Israel. Yeah, yeah. And they also, we know Herod, the one of the leaders with whom we've had the most tortured relationship as Jews. He refurbished the temple in its entirety. It was a multi-year project, you know, tens of thousands of workers, actually not slave workers, interestingly, even though he was not someone who was bound by the most stringent moral code, but he didn't use slave labor to do that, and he refurbished the entire temple. And the Talmud says that if you never saw Herod's temple, you never saw a beautiful building in your life. Like, this was stunning, gorgeous, described like these waves of blue marble that were on the roof, and like they would have people walk in from one entrance and leave the other entrance because they didn't want people to see the same thing twice, because it was so awe-striking the first time you saw it. That lasting image would just, you know, just constantly accompany you the rest of your life. So you would walk in and walk out in different, different locales. So you don't see it twice. Once you see, even the most remarkable thing in the world, if you see it twice, well, it loses its luster.
It always does.
Yeah. So either way, that's the idea of the red heifer. You find a red cow. You find a cow that's entirely red. You slaughter it outside of Jerusalem. You make the pile of ashes. You put in the whole thing, and then you sprinkle on people. Now, is this something that we understand? Absolutely not. In fact, this is always the representative of a law or a mitzvah that we cannot understand as humans. You know, you look at most mitzvahs, you know, they make some degree of sense. Either they make sense, you know, off the bat, or they'll make sense to you once they're explained, you know. So we talk about Shabbat. Well, why would you take a day off? Well, we can explain that. Well, the idea of family, the idea of solitude, the idea of removal of yourself from everything that goes on, the idea of reflection, you know, that, you know, the idea of having a spiritual oasis, all these things we can explain. Yeah, off the bat, maybe Shabbat doesn't make any sense. But once we talked about it, Shabbat, tzitzit, prayer, all the mitzvahs essentially, not all the mitzvahs, most of the mitzvahs either make sense off the bat or make sense once we dig in a little deeper, talk about the sources. This mitzvah, it's so bizarre. And in fact, there's some counterintuitive laws as well. You know, so we have the guy who's sprinkling the ashes, and then when they have the people that are sprinkled upon, right? So we have the impure people, they come in, and the guy who is pure, he's the sprinkler, right? Yes, he's got to be pure. And then he sprinkles, and they get pure, and he gets impure. That doesn't make any sense. If he's the one who is pure, and with the purification process, why would there be this counterintuitive result wherein the sprinkler who is pure becomes impure by purifying? This doesn't make any sense. Now, truth be told, his degree of impurity is not quite the same degree as their impurity. He doesn't need to have the sprinkling done to him, because then it would just be forever, right? He just needs to go to the mikvah and wait till nighttime, wash his clothing, and it's good to go. But still, it doesn't make any sense. It seems like the opposite. You know, he would come even purer, or he would remain pure. Why would it be that the purifier himself becomes impure via this purification process?
Because he's changed by the experience.
But he would be changed for the positive.
Maybe because he's in the company with the impure person, but he's not having any ashes put on him.
But he's not. Let's say who says he's not coming in contact with them? He's just throwing stuff on them.
So where is it described?
So this is described in the book of Numbers, which we just read last week. Chukas. And this is the way it starts. This is the chukah satorah, which means the chot of the Torah. Chot means a statute. Where there's three classifications of laws. There's edus, mishpatim, and chot, or chukim, which are the three classifications of laws. Either the laws that are mishpat, which makes sense off the bat, don't steal, don't murder, don't rape. Everyone understands that. Many other societies have independently reached that same conclusion. Makes a lot of sense. You have the edus, which is the mitzvahs that make sense after some explanation. Once you learn a little bit about it, and then you have these other mitzvahs, a much smaller section of mitzvahs that don't make any sense at all. This is the prototype. This is the quintessential. This is the archetype of the mitzvah. It makes no sense. Among those mitzvahs are the mitzvah of shatnez. Shatnez is don't wear a garment made of wool and linen. You can wear a wool garment, no problem. You can wear a linen garment, no problem. Just don't make a garment mixed of wool and linen. No, why not? If wool's fine and linen's fine, why is the marriage of the two not fine? And you know what? You could scour all of Jewish writing, you won't really find much help in that. This is something that we do it because the Almighty told us to do it. And we know from the bat we're not going to understand. You know, off the bat we're going to know we're not going to understand. Then we just do it. You know? And today, when you have a wool suit, I bring it to the Shatnez lab. We have in Houston two labs. Whose sole goal is to inspect garments for shatnez. And they have these loops, and they have the know-how of discerning what material is used, and they know where the linen is most likely going to be, and that would be either the lining or the lining of the collar, or the lining inside the suit, or the thread that ties the buttons together. You know, and they inspect that and see if it's shatnez. And if it is shatnez, then either you return to the store or you take out the shatnez.
So whenever you buy a suit, a wool suit, the lining is going to be of what? Usually
it'll be wool.
Polyester.
Or polyester, that's right. In expensive suits, or more expensive, it could be linen as well. It's not likely. But it's still possible.
So you're saying, given if it says like 100% wool,
you 100% wool, there, but it might say sure, it might right? say 100% wool, except they say the, what do they say?
They'll say the lining.
Oh, or it might say except decorations or something like that, which might mean the buttons are not wool, right? Obviously, you know,
obviously
so that
they're not going to be
right. But the thread that a minor thread wouldn't necessarily change the label. That's the risk.
So just basically to make sure, just like rabbi supervise like kosher.
Exactly. Now I've never had a suit that has shatnez in it. Most likely because the kind of suits that I buy are not that expensive.
Okay, where do you buy your suits?
I guess not in Gucci or Hugo Boss or whatever. And therefore I haven't had a problem, but a lot of people do. You know, the more expensive the suit is, the more likely it is to have some degree of linen in it. Now, it might have just a negligible amount. You just pull out the string and that's it. But either way, this is a mitzvah that we do, and it's a mitzvah of the Torah, and it's not something that makes any sense to us.
I have a stupid question. You're talking about, and it's not stupid, but okay, you can mix some linen and wool. I understand that. Can you wear a cotton shirt with the wool jacket on top, even though they weren't sewn together?
Is it a garment of wool and linen? Yes. So you can wheel a linen.
You're wearing a cotton shirt, let's say. I don't know what you're wearing. But say you're not
wearing linen, you mean linen.
Okay, you're wearing a linen shirt. And your suit is wool. Can you wear them together?
Yes, no problem. It's not a garment of wool linen. That's no problem.
It's
so you can wear two garments, exactly. So you can wear a linen shirt, like some people wear linen shirts in the summer. And you can wear a wool suit, no problem.
So if she was wearing linen, she would not wear wool.
Yeah.
Even in another garment.
Interesting. Hmm.
I was in a study one time where we were talking about this. Well, we can't mix the two. But when we look at the high priest garments, I think the sash is a mixture of wool and linen. And the idea came out of this discussion that if we wear common garments made of wool and linen mixed, we'd have made what is holy common. And because it's the high priest wears the wool and the linen combined, we should not.
Yeah, that's very interesting because the garments of the Kohen are made out of shatnez. And in fact, the Talmud also says that if you have, let's say, a garment of any garment of mitzvah, like for example, a garment of tzitzit, right? That, if it's made out of wool and linen, then you're okay.
It's a loophole.
Well, it's a loophole. But if it is the garment that's a four-corner garment that you put tzitzit on it, then because it's a positive mitzvah, the positive mitzvah overrides the negative prohibition. Thus, you have two things at play. You have the positive mitzvah of wearing tzitzit. You have the negative prohibition of not wearing shatnez. So the positive overrides the negative. So what you're saying is a nice idea. But still, it's always considered an example of a chort. In fact, the Torah itself says that it's a chort. This is a mitzvah that we don't seem to have the understanding to it. And above all, at the king of these kinds of mitzvahs is the red heifer or the red cow. And in fact, we know that the Talmud says, I believe it's a midrash, that says that Moses is the only one who understood this mitzvah. Why? Because God just spelled it out for him. And King Solomon, he spent his time praying, let me understand this, and he has no idea, can't understand it. And it seems like it's designed to, or maybe we're designed, either way, it's designed for us to not understand. Right? It's not, there's no overlap, there's no interface where human intelligence can, have a touch point with the intelligence or behind this mitzvah, or the understanding behind this mitzvah. Now, I think the question I think that is the appropriate question for this idea is that, okay, so it's a mitzvah that we do not do anymore. Number one,
heifer.
The other one, heifer, right? Because we have no temple, we got no, we have no red heifers. We don't do this, right? On one hand, on the other hand, it's a mitzvah that we cannot understand either. So it seems like it's just removed from any value for us. It's can there be anything that we can glean? Can there be any insight that we can take away? Can there be any lesson that we can use with this idea? The idea of there's something there that we could learn, we could maybe observe in some, in some other situation, in some of the, if we had a temple, but we can understand what the process is, but we don't understand the reason behind it. And my question that I want to stress today is some ideas, perhaps, as to, how to harness this mitzvah and the idea behind this mitzvah and the idea behind us doing something and not understanding it, or studying something and not understanding the reason behind it, and having some incomplete, acceptance of of the mitzvah and how that could potentially be very positive.
May I just double Go ahead. Check? You said, just I might have misunderstood, that nowadays we do not practice
Yes. Yes. Mitzvah. Yes.
So if, say, a very observant Jew in Borpark gets impure for whatever reason,
All, everyone in the world is impure, is considered impure.
Yes.
So babies are born in hospitals, right? We start of day one. We're impure.
So now everybody is impure.
Everyone's size of impure. Everyone's considered impure. No one has a status of purity.
And you have no way of remedying.
Now, the question is, what does that mean? So what's the relevance of being impure?
Newborns also impure.
I'm saying they're born in hospitals, I said. By the way, in Israeli hospitals, the second someone dies, they wheel them into like a hermetically sealed morgue. Because they know, like, there's likelihood that there are Kohens walking in and out. Especially the hospitals that have more, sensitivity towards religion.
You know, like, in the Christian faith, the concept of original sin from the time you're born. And so we're...
No, it's not a sin. It's not a sin. It's just a reality. It's a reality that really has no relevant... meaning to us, because we don't have a temple. So what does it mean? You can live your whole life, you're impure. So what does that mean? Does it mean you're a bad person? No.
Somebody became impure, unclean, doesn't mean they've
sinned. I wouldn't say unclean. I don't like to say unclean. It's impure. You're very clean. You shower every day. You're very clean. It doesn't mean that you're unclean. It just means that you can't walk into the temple. We don't have a temple anyhow. So what is the difference? But the one difference that would make is that we can't walk into the temple. Now, the location of the temple as well is someplace you can't walk. Okay, that's why this is the reason why. If you ever heard that Jews don't walk into Temple Mount, this is the reason why. Because we are impure, and thus we cannot walk into the location of the temple. Even though the temple's not there, the location itself demands ritual purity.
Yeah, because on several occasions you mentioned that observant Jews should not go.
That's right. That this is the only reason why.
Right, Temple Mount.
That's the only reason why. That's right.
Jews try to go on the Temple Mount all the time.
And the Jews that do it, if they have... Well, but if they're working with the laws of impurity, I mean, they would try to walk around Temple Mount in the place that the temple did not stand.
So when Sharon went to the Temple Mount,
12
years ago with hundreds of police, they just treaded lightly, right around.
I don't know. It's a good question.
The incident, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. It didn't start. It was an excuse. Just like today is the anniversary, I believe, today or yesterday, anniversary of Archduke Ferdinand's assassination. Yeah, it kicked off 101 years ago. They kicked off World War. Is that really what kicked off World War One? Is that's the whole reason why?
Just a spark.
No, it was the spark, exactly. Spark that ignited the conflict that was bound to happen regardless.
Those hundreds of Jews went there, so it's a violation.
Oh, no, Arafat started. Yeah, it's like, this Jews, let's have another jihad.
I'm talking when they intifada. They did not go to...
I don't know. I don't know the exact route.
Well, it's my understanding that they don't know exactly...
There are a few different opinions. Yes, it's a few hundred feet away from each other. It's not far. But most opinions agree that where the Dome of the Rock, the shrine, is actually the epicenter of where the temple was. Because there's this rock inside there, and the rock is mentioned in the Mishnah. Which, by the way, all these things precede. Islam was founded in the 7th century. The temple's destroyed 700 years earlier. Right? In the year 70, the temple's destroyed.
All right.
And the Mishnah talks about this rock. There's written in the year 200. So... because it now it looks like this is a Muslim site. Actually, no, it's a Muslim site, but it was many hundred years earlier preceded by being a very important Jewish site. Yeah, go ahead. I'll give you a second.
But if you become impure by touching a dead body, don't you go into mikvah to get purified?
Not for this purposes. The mikvah, there's so many different kinds of purity and impurity. Some of them could be remedied by mikvah. Direct contact with the dead person can only be remedied with regards to going into the temple by the red cow. It's the only way to do it.
Okay, because how women, when they are impure, because of their...
Yeah, it's a mikvah, no problem.
Yeah.
Mikvah is a ritual bath.
Yeah, it's yeah, exactly. Also, another mitzvah we could say is leaning or favoring very closely this idea of a chok, of a statute that it doesn't make any sense to us.
People who are very religious have to do the mikvah and everything like that before, or even if they went to and they've gone in contact with a dead person before going into the Orthodox place of worship. Or
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Somebody who is very religious, it's a question. Does that person have to do something before going into another place of worship?
Okay, so two things. First of all, I don't know what very religious means. You mean very observant, like observant?
Yeah, like somebody who's Orthodox.
Observant, okay. Do they need to go to the mikvah before what?
I don't know if they went in contact when they went
No, remember, common kind of dead people only has significance with regards to going to the temple and eating sacrificial foods. Thus, that's the only significance that it has. You're not unclean. You're just impure vis-a-vis going into the temple, eating sacrificial foods, and it can only be undone with one process as delineated in last week's parsha of the red cow.
So basically, we're all impure.
And it means nothing for us.
And we can't do anything about it. We have to just live with it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the word impure symbolizes or, you know, we hear something bad. It's not bad. It's just... We should probably use the Hebrew word. We're tame. It's just all it means is that we can't walk into the temple. That's all it means, you know.
Given that there's no temple,
I'm impure. You're impure. Our kids are impure. Our grandparents were impure. Everyone that we know was impure,
so
and that's fine.
Until the temple is rebuilt,
exactly.
There's no practical consequence.
Yes, and by the way, I'll mention. This is just a little loophole that you wanted. Another loophole.
I love loopholes.
That actually, what it says is, and this is by the way, 1/6 of Jewish law is dedicated to these laws of purity and impurity. So much is written about it. It's not very practical for us, but it's an enormous part of Jewish. All the, like, you know, people can become impure, food can become impure, vessels can become impure, house can become impure, in so many different ways, but. It does say tumah hutra b'tzibur, which means that if the majority, 51% of the nation is impure, then the laws of impurity are waived. It means if the majority of the people are impure, or if the majority of anything is impure, then it would be allowed. I mentioned this.
Have a battle or something, right?
That's right. I mentioned this we talked about Hanukkah, that they had only one pure jug of oil. But the truth is, because they were impure, therefore, and the majority of people were impure, therefore, it was allowed. So ironically, they didn't even need the pure oil. But either way, this is the loophole that let's say Messiah arrives tomorrow, like we mentioned last week, and the temple is built by the end of the week. Okay, let's assume that that's true. Well, no Jews can walk in, right? Well, no. Well, under that situation, either we find the red heifer that's pure, so we go scouring Texas hill country to find one that's actually, because there's lots and lots and lots of red cows, you know, out there. Find one that's perfect. Or if we can't find the one that's perfect, then we're okay. The prohibition of walking to the temple when we're impure is only when there's a possibility of purity, and in fact, the majority of people are pure. When the majority of people are impure, then it'll be fine. There was a question here.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
So, 51%.
Yes. So.
Oh, but we're okay. Most people in Texas are Republicans.
So, does this have anything to do with the Messianic coming? The red heifer.
I don't think so necessarily, because I think that, you know, like, it would be bundled together with all the other, like, once. Like the idea of Messiah we spoke about last week, it would mean building the temple. So once the temple is built, well, then all temple functions have to resume. Thus, we'll start scouring the place for red cows. And you find the red cows and bring them to the temple, you know. But until then, we're okay. I think it is tangentially related to the idea of Messiah and the idea of reinstituting sacrificial and ritual law.
Recently, a series called Dig. Yeah. And
I saw part of that.
I saw a couple of them. It takes place in Jerusalem, actually, and these people are trying to bring her back. trying to protect the red heifer.
Is this fiction or is fictional?
Well, it's supposed to be based on...
It's fiction.
Tradition. It's fiction, but it's supposed to be based on tradition.
It doesn't even take place in Jerusalem. They play like it does, but it doesn't.
That's not where they filmed it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not.
I was enjoying the scenery.
No, sorry.
Where did they film it?
Yeah, but it's like any other apocalyptic movie. It's probably the plot and the screenplay twisted to suit to keep the interest of the audience, not really how it's supposed to
be. Well, I figured they must have gotten that part from someplace.
They just took some juicy part and then probably make it even juicier, right?
Okay.
By ungrounding it in the ungrounding from the religious text.
Every so time I hear about the red heifer, I think of that show.
Yeah, me too.
So
I didn't understand a whole lot about.
So millions of people have been misinformed.
Well, what did it say? About what?
About looking for the red heifer to bring about the Messiah. It was a pivotal part of the plot.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, it's like some lone, I only saw the commercial, some lone FBI agents tries to stop those evil Jewish sect from ending the world.
Oh, no, it was also Christian.
But either way, this is not a new thing. This is already in the Torah. This is a very, very ancient practice. You know, Moses was the one who did the first red heifer. Okay, so what's the lesson for us? You know, we read about this. It's very interesting, I guess. It's very intriguing. It's a lot of questions for us. More questions than answers. So, but something we don't do, we don't practice in any way. None of us are actually impacting your life in any way. It's not something you can understand either. So what could be the lesson? Is there anything we can learn from the fact that we cannot understand? So I have a few ideas I wanted to share here. I'll see what you guys think. I think off the bat, I think we could make an argument. Maybe you guys will agree, maybe won't. But I think it's a good argument to be made that it does call into the question the argument of human authorship of the Torah. Of human authorship of the Torah. Why do I say that? If the Torah was written by humans, we could safely make the deduction that it was written by intelligent humans. Why is that? Well, it's a very best-selling book, and it's captivated a nation, and it's the premier book of morality for the world. It's the dominant book for the most dominant guide that has ever been published, on one hand. On the other hand, the predictions are uncanny, like we mentioned in the previous class. The predictions of the Torah are uncanny, so someone had to have the incredible foresight to just extrapolate, you know, thousands of years down the line and make predictions that are uncannily accurate. It has zero mistakes, even though it's very diverse subject matter. So it's very intelligent, yet we see something that no human intelligence could possibly come up with. I don't think. It doesn't seem to have any overlap. It seems to be also inconsistent. Like if this is something of, would a human author conceive of this? And would a human author trying to impersonate, masquerade as a divine power, would they put in something which is so bizarre? I think it's a good argument. I don't know if it's rock solid. I don't know if it's super tight. But I think it's something to call into question. Like, okay, we have these things in the Torah. What human author in the right mind would actually conceive of this and actually put this in the final book? To impersonate God or representing God with this kind of intelligence. I think it's a nice argument, psychologically to make. I think it's a worthy argument. I don't know if it's, like I said, I don't know if it's maybe the argument, the counter argument would be, well, yeah, you want to make believe that you're not human, so you would do something. It's a lot. It's a further development of that argument has to be made. Well, the human author or authors would try to be so clever to not only predict things that are super accurate, to not make any mistakes, to be accepted by millions of people as the Word of God, to talk about events that have not been disproven as for sure, to make bold predictions that are once. In all of history predictions, like we mentioned, the people being bounced out of the land and kicked and coming back, that's happened twice, and it's happened only twice, and both times to the Jewish people, foretold in the Torah. Not only all of that, yet to also write things that are just so out there and so strange, I think that's a good argument. That's just an idea. An entirely different idea is the idea of reliance on God. You know, I think when we observe the Torah, you know, so we fulfill the mitzvahs and we eat the matzah, we have the mezuzah, we observe, we go to the prayer, we do the, you know, we do the liturgy, and you know, we do, you know, we observe the Torah, and we could say, well, that makes a lot of sense. I can explain to you why we wear tefillin, why we have tzitzis, and why we, you know, return lost objects to their owner, and you know, why we don't do any bad things because it's bad. And if everything makes sense, you know, then we're, could be essentially, we're just following what makes sense. And then we're relying on ourselves, essentially. And what happens when you rely on yourself? What could result? If we're only governed by what we understand and by what we find to be moral, and thus, when the Torah says something that we say is immoral, well, then we disregard it. Or we want to create our own model of morality. What happens then? There's a good argument to be made. Once again, I think this is a good debate perhaps we can have. I think of a better argument. That when humans or even societies are left on their own, to their own accords, to try to determine what is right and what is wrong, abject immorality can result. We know, we look at the Romans. The Romans were a very organized, intellectual people. You know, they were way ahead of themselves as, you know, humanists. They were people that were governed by law and by logic and by reason. That these are the hallmarks of Roman culture. And yet, they are the culture that had decided that it was right and moral that if someone was a petty criminal, then they should be torn up by a lion to the cheering crowds. That was moral. And they would have sometimes 10,000 people would be slaughtered, and while everyone watched, could you imagine? And cheered on, exactly. They would have the little perfume bottles that were occasionally being sprayed so people wouldn't gag from all the blood. Hey. You know, and the idea of a gladiator, just people fighting to the death. This was real. We still have... This is not just from the movies. This is not Russell Crowe here. Are you not entertained? Right. That's it's not that. This is real, and this is what a society developed. You know, and I think that when they were doing that, like to them, this was moral. This was right. What do you mean? Someone is a petty criminal. You know, they did shoplift something. Of course, this is what's right. And it was a moral. I think they would argue that it would be a moral argument as well, justifying what they did. And to us now, we look at that as being savage and being, you know, terribly, you know. So you mentioned that you're against the death penalty. You're a death. I heard that coming in. You were talking to someone else. Apologize for eavesdropping. But you know, you're perhaps like, if you're against the death penalty, you're against the death penalty even for murderers and rapists, right? Even the guy in Norway who shot up 77 kids. If you're against the death penalty, you're against the death penalty. Are you okay with someone being a petty criminal being savagely torn apart by a lion to everyone else's amusement?
Well, the poor kid has to eat.
That guy did in California, all he stole was a cupcake. That black guy that got shot.
Yeah, well, but that's not the spur of the moment. That's not like via the judicial system. So I think that's the argument that once you are saying I'm going to rely on my own faculties and not on God at all, then that could, and I think even recently with the Nazis, you know, the Nazis, their extermination.
Well, now I have no problem with death penalty.
Well, I'm sorry.
With the Nazis, I have no problem applying death penalty.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I told you there were exceptions.
Loopholes.
So we know that, obviously, we know that Hitler based his genocidal plans a lot on moral principles. But even that, even forget about the Jews for a second. Even forget about the Holocaust or even before the war. When Hitler instituted a policy of infanticide. If a baby was born in the 1930s in Germany who was slightly disabled, to them, it was justified, it was right, it was moral to exterminate that baby.
It's eugenics. It started around the turn of the century.
Right, but Hitler instituted it.
Yeah, that's where he got it from.
All Raza Institute.
But
Russia
no, but the,
Rome,
the Romans did as well, by the way. The Romans also did it.
It, and it could have gone back, yeah, even further. It was any type of imperfection.
I believe there's a great, I think there's even a quote from Aristotle toward that, that's what's right and moral. Doodle after the class, Aristotle
the
infanticide.
But the thing that's challenging about Germany and Hitler, and that is such an educated society.
And they voted him in. Remember, he was elected. Well, he was elected by whatever, you know, however you want to. It was democratically accepted upon himself. But my argument is that this was not just about, you know, genocidal, you know, murderous, megalomaniacal, just hatred. It was about morals. And that the idea of not having some baby burden society with their disabilities. And like I said, very rational, very reasonable, very advanced society accepted that. Now, to me, this is an example of the folly of reliance, entire reliance on what we decide. You know, it's the news today. This is obviously a very controversial topic. But, you know, they just made the whole gay marriage thing, right? And as recently as 2008, when Obama was campaigning first time, they asked him, what do you think define marriage? And he said, marriage is between a man and a woman, and the whole sacred thing, and as a Christian, he mentioned that. You know, there's a video. I saw the video yesterday. Last night, I saw the video.
My how times have changed. Now the White House is lit up in rainbow colors.
Now, but what does that mean? Is marriage sacred like Obama himself? You know, the crazy white right-winger that he was 2008. You know, it was only a couple of years ago. Well, what is it? You know, so it's something that is it a moral issue or is it not a moral issue? Well, it seems like it changed. Now,
I think it's still a moral issue. I think that the compass of America has changed.
So what we're saying is that it's suddenly not a moral issue, the idea of sanctity of marriage. It's suddenly not, well, marriage is more malleable. Well, what changed over that? What actually changed over that over the 6 years? Nothing. It's just that as humans, we're making decisions, and thus something which may or may not be moral, we don't know. But if it is immoral, then it's immoral regardless of what other people think about it. Is that right? Can we agree on that?
No.
If it's a moral issue, well, let's assume maybe it isn't the moral issue. But if it is a moral issue, then it doesn't matter what people think about it. If it's a moral issue, you know, if there's some sanctity to it, then there is sanctity to it. And if there's no sanctity, there's no sanctity to it. But once we say there is sanctity to it, like Obama himself said, that doesn't change over 6 years.
It's not a moral. It's not about moral or immoral. It's about the societal consensus on morality evolves.
But that's not what he said.
4,000 years.
That's not what he said.
It was moral to have slaves. It was moral to have multiple wives, right? Now it's not, and we consider this moral. So it's.
I'm just. My only state is like this. The man himself, okay, the man himself. Whatever you think about him, is on record for saying that it's an issue of morality and sanctity of marriage and religion, that marriage is one man, one woman. That's what he said. Thus, if that was true, it still is true. I don't know if it was true or not. I'm saying if it was true at one point, it's still true now. It doesn't change.
God,
that's my only point.
Yeah,
I'm just saying. My only point is that if the humans are making decisions, then it's very subjective to what society says. Thus, if society, I'm not comparing gay marriage or whatever to infanticide. Don't quote me on that. But I'm saying if society,
if there are moral absolutes, then there are moral absolutes.
That's right.
If they're not, they're not.
That's right. And thus, if you make a claim that there is a moral absolute, that doesn't change. And when we rely solely on
our capacity,
on us, then everything's on the table. Everything, as we see with every society, every single society. What was the problem with the Romans? Well, the problem was that they, at that time, the society was very amenable to the idea of absolute, what we would consider to be absolute savagery. The Nazis as well. We could talk about many, 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 many other societies. We know the Jewish people. You just look at the path of the Jewish people throughout Europe in the past 1,000 years. And the idea of burning the Jews at the stake because they don't accept JC, that was okay in many, many societies. Is that okay? I don't think it's okay. But once we are solely relying on our own capacity to make these decisions, that can result. Now, when we say, when we have a mitzvah like this, the mitzvah is forcing us to say, we don't understand. Because there's no other way to accept the mitzvah. And we even tell it, tzachot, that this is something you won't understand. What is it forcing us to do? It's forcing us to say, we're not relying on ourselves. You can't possibly rely on yourselves in this mitzvah. We're only just doing it because the Almighty says to do it. What that potentially does is changes our focus. It changes what is going to govern our decisions. It forces us, at least in this one little area of life, but hopefully that will progress to other areas of life. It'll force us to have at least here, but maybe other places, the process going on within ourselves that we're doing something, not because we understand it, right? Not because we're relying on our own self, but we're relying on God. And he has a proven track record, and thus we rely on that. Now, how does this perhaps develop? You know, I was thinking that, you know, what happens to someone when they're okay with things that they don't understand? I gave this example before. I'll say it again. I think for a man, it's very, very, very hard to understand the value of flowers for a woman. It is, to me, it's almost entirely irrational. It doesn't make any sense. I tell you, it makes more sense the red heifer thing. It's, you're buying
really
something.
Tiptoeing in tulips right now.
Flowers, I can understand. Diamonds and
stuff. No, that's, no, that, no, but.
A diamond lasts forever. The flowers are gone. In
yeah, but Tali, that's just the price tag. The flowers don't make less sense because they disappear. It's just that you're okay because this is like a tax.
I was looking into Torah for the mitzvah to buy diamonds. For my wife. Couldn't find any.
Couldn't find any, right?
Yeah.
So like to me, like this is...
Her, but it didn't work.
You know, this is... We had a...
It just makes you a
giant. My wife and I had a reason to go to Canada. This week, my mother-in-law was sitting Shiva, so we went to Canada. I went for a day, and Chaya went for 2 days. But either way, during the day that I was in, we were both in Canada. We brought the baby, but we have three other kids, so we put them out by friends, whatever. They stayed overnight by friends' houses. So I was saying, well, it's nice to buy them something nice, you know. We should buy them something nice. So I was saying, oh, let's give them a bottle of wine for Shabbos, something like that. Like, no, not wine. We should buy them flowers. Why would we buy flowers? Why would anyone buy flowers?
I hope you language this ever so gently with her.
Well, I said, okay, I'm going to defer to you, not because I understand it, but because I'm just accepting it as a reality that Jay just is.
It's a mitzvah.
You know, and I think that's. It's very frustrating to be in this state. Like, it's frustrating to have to do something. All the women are looking at me like I'm crazy. It's insane. But it's frustrating to be in the situation where you're doing something, you kind of have to do something, and you don't understand it.
My husband and I bought a house that we're renovating, and I said to my husband here, we have to do something with this kitchen. And he looked at me like I had grown two heads. And he said, well, what do you need? And I said, well, I hate these kitchen cabinets. And he said, well, you've got a kitchen. It's got a stove. It's got a refrigerator. It's got a sink. It's got cabinets. What for do you need something different? And I looked at him like he had grown two heads. And so the battle began.
It's like women have a special guidebook, how to stump your husband. In 60 seconds.
Yeah, but remember, it's not, I don't think it's a guy, but I think it's hardwired.
Yeah, it's like women just totally don't understand the value of V8 with a supercharger.
Agreed.
Is that a car?
It's a TV part of a program car. On how to kill your husband.
You know. So, I was thinking, like it's a very valuable skill for someone to be okay with doing something that doesn't make sense to them. Because invariably in your life, you're going to do things. Now, it might be things you know, obviously in relationships, I think this is highlighted a lot. But anytime there's any conflict with you and your spouse, or you and a professional relationship, there's going to be times where you're going to have to compromise. And you have to do something which, to you know, in your best assessment of the situation, is wrong, or at least is suboptimal or makes no sense. But the right thing to do is to do something that you think is wrong, or you think is suboptimal, or you think that makes no sense, or you think it's a waste of time. And it's a very valuable skill to have that. Now it's a skill. What's the skill? The skill is to accept something that you don't understand. And I think that perhaps maybe this is one of the lessons that we could take from this mitzvah, is that we're told from the get-go, this is something that we do, we will never understand. And the question is, well, why? We know most mitzvahs we do understand. Most mitzvahs either we understand off the bat or we understand once we learn about them. But there's something that we will never understand. And that's okay, I think. And I think it's okay because that in itself is the lesson. The lesson is that you don't understand, but you do it anyhow. And now you are becoming a better person because now you are someone who is getting used to the idea of doing something that you don't understand. And I think that's very valuable.
The way I see why we don't understand this sacrifice or this impurity ritual is me as a mom with my kids, whenever they're doing something wrong, I tell them not to do it. And my daughter, I have an 18-year-old daughter. And I tell her a lot of things that I don't want her to do, like mistakes that I have done. She doesn't understand it, but I still want her to do it, and she sometimes chooses to listen to me, sometimes she doesn't. So I see it as that's how God does it. He tells us to do something because he knows that it's good for us, but yet we don't have that understanding. And later on, like I grew up and I'm a mom, now I understand why my mom would tell me, don't do this, do that, because of this. I didn't understand her before, but now that I'm a mom, I understand why she...
So that's a good example, because...
That's a wonderful analogy.
Yeah, because you're coming from... It means you have different intelligence,
yes,
than your child. Thus, to you it's so clear, but to them it's so bizarre. And I even think you could downscale that a little bit by saying, like, if you see a young child, like a three-year-old or two-year-old, who's playing with the ball and the ball rolls into the street... Right, and they make a lunge after her, and you see the tractor trailer heading their way. You go and you tackle them. That's what you do, because you're able to connect the dots with your superior intelligence. The child thinks that his parent hates them. The child thinks, sounds like my mom hates me. I want to get the ball, and the mom tackles me. She loathes me. I can't believe it. This is my mom. You know, so that's the disconnect. And I think that's a very good example. Like, well, God has his intelligence, and we're like the little babies, you know, compared to God's intelligence, where the gap between our intelligence and our newborn or toddler's intelligence is, by orders of magnitude, smaller than the gap of our intelligence and God's intelligence. God's telling us, do this, this is, makes sense to me, and we can accept that because it makes sense to him, and, you know, that's okay, but it's a good way to think about it. Very,
and later,
yeah,
on,
maybe yes, maybe no, or maybe we'll still need a lesson.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's maybe we'll get to know more insight, or maybe not. And maybe the lesson is still valuable. We still become better people by doing something that we don't understand.
Well, it's empirical evidence that was at play here in regards to Lydia's case, for example, or any case. She's already learned that, hey, this don't work. That's why she's trying to impart the information to her daughter,
mm-hmm,
even though she didn't agree with it when her mom told her. But it's empirical evidence that she's learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lessons learned.
I want to expand the conversation here a little bit. I want to ask a few questions. We know when you read the books of the Torah, we find the nation in Egypt. They're slaves, of course. Then they have 10 plagues, miraculous 10 plagues, and they suddenly, they're out of Egypt, and they start splitting seas, and they're at Mount Sinai, and they get food from heaven, and it's all the miracles are suddenly just dropping by left, right, and center. And then, right afterwards, they start worshiping golden calves, and sending spies, and rejecting Moses, and it seems to be like, you know, very sporadic, very weird behavior. It seems, especially in light of what they saw, what they encountered, what they witnessed, the miracles, and the leadership of Moses and the prophecy of Moses, yet they question his authority. They rebel. They seem to be behaving in a way that is not at all reflective of what they experienced.
Right.
So that's one of the common questions that we have. How could there be such a disconnect between what the people understood, the insight that they gleaned, and the behavior that they displayed? You know, we just read last week about Korach. Korach leads a rebellion against the people, against Moses. A week before that, we read about the spies. The spies, they go to Israel, they come back, and they start convincing everyone that Moses is baloney, and they start rebelling against Moses. The red heifer, the golden calf, whatever. Either way, by the way, those two are linked as well. That the red heifer is an atonement for the golden calf. A heifer and a calf, they're both from the cow family.
Well, aside from the foreign interventionists, if you will, that travel with Moses when they come out of the Egypt or the Exodus, they didn't have Edward G. Robinson, that's for sure, like in the Bible. But anyway, they got complacent. I mean, we're taking this for granted here, all this. We're complacent.
It's kind of like in the corporate world where they say, yeah, you made $1 million for me last month, but what have you done for me today? And they're kind of, they forgot about the cloud by day and the fire by night and the, you know, and all of the
they
miracles that were going on.
They become complacent with it. That's what I'm saying. As a result, and they said, then fear set in. Oh my gosh, we're going to do things for ourselves because Moses is not coming down off the hill. Wait a minute. Let's go back to the old days when we had the golden calf.
Yeah, but it seems like it's, I think that these are both for sure contributors to the behavior, but it seems like it wasn't just, you know, one time thing, the miracles. It was ongoing.
Yes. Yeah.
So if in the morning you got food from manna fell from heaven, you know, and then at night you're gonna say, oh, you know, let's get a golden calf, you know. It seems to be, you know, very strange, especially when you're living in a miraculous environment, to start, you know, erecting for yourself a idol, worshiping it, saying
was
this.
Was it everyone?
Well, it wasn't everyone, but still, you know. Yes, of course. The truth is, it wasn't everyone. It was a small part. But still, the theme of the time in the wilderness, at least at the beginning, was this dichotomy where, on one hand, they seem to have had all the reasons in the world to behave and stay in line, you know, and not question Moses, not question God. Yet they start questioning God. We know that this past week's parsha, Miriam dies, and suddenly the water that was coming from the rock ceases, and they start complaining. We know earlier that when they ran away from Mount Sinai, it was, you know, the verse says they ran away, and they just were so excited to leave, as if like a small child running away from school, liberation. We don't have to study anymore. So we see just inconsistency. Or at least perceive the consistency of what they should have done versus what they did. So like I said, each individual instance, episode, has to be judged on its own, of course. But overall, big picture, we see so many reasons for them to toe the line and so many instances where they behaved in a manner that, you know, seems very strange.
But they were for hundreds of years slaves and...
prison mentality.
Well, yeah, they didn't. They had their ways of doing things. And then here they're only out free in the desert with Moses for a very short time in comparison. So, yeah, anytime any kind of a problem came in, I think it's human nature to kind of go.
I agree with you. I
go
think
back
you revert
to what was safe.
So perhaps we could present it in a different way. Perhaps change takes a little bit longer. Means it's not just reverting back. It means that even if you have the tremendous, the most insightful experiences in the world, to actually change who you are, it's to take more time, or maybe more something else. It means just experiencing Mount Sinai and having prophecy, and having to be resuscitated back to life because you died because you couldn't handle the prophecy, and just seeing what they saw and experiencing and hearing what they heard, that is the most transcendental experience you could possibly have. Yet to change who you are fundamentally, more has to happen.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who had this quote, big things are only seen at a distance,
mm-hmm.
from a distance. So if just yesterday you crossed the part of the Red Sea, or you see this guy Moses, maybe 200 years from now, everybody will see Moses for the giant he was. But he, if he is your contemporary neighbor, you do not appreciate the full greatness of the man.
Doesn't it say in Torah that if they did not accept the laws, that God would start over again with a different group of people that did it?
A few times it almost happened. Moses had intervened, right? After the golden calf, God says, okay, listen, I'm done with these people. We're going to start from scratch. And Moses starts praying. We know that prayer, by the way, is forever enshrined in Jewish prayer. It's a prayer we do on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, the prayer that Moses did to intervene on behalf of the people.
Plus, they were in the process of learning all those laws and learning how to live a new life, because all their lives they were slaves, and now they have all this super powers that they have this cloud by day, and then they have the fire at night, and I think that's something they would understand, they would see. But then all those other laws, it was hard, I would say it would be hard for them. It was a process that they were going through to accept that new life they were going to have.
So let's talk more about this process, but I want to also introduce another character, Bilam or Balaam. Somehow in English it became Balaam, I don't know why, but in Hebrew it's actually Bilam. So he is this prophet who's actually not Jewish. And we know that there were many non-Jewish prophets as well. Well, not many, but there were some. And in fact, Bilam is the greatest non-Jewish prophet out there. In fact, his prophecy was so complete that in the end of the Torah, it talks about Moses, the epithet of Moses. It says that Moses was the greatest prophet the Jewish people will ever see. This is Jewish people, but the whole entire world. As well, Bilam rivaled Moses. Bilam was a prophet in such a degree that he was able to be in the same level as Moses, almost, or at least in the same level, or in the same ballpark as Moses. Thus, Moses is the greatest prophet the Jewish people have ever seen, but the Gentiles have seen it as well. And we know it says that he knew the knowledge of God. So the verse says, Yodea das Elon. He knew God, like he understood God, so to speak. And in fact, it says that he actually knew the precise instant, if he wanted to curse someone or bless someone, he knew the precise instant in which to do it, and he was able to be very, very successful in his sorcery or whatever he did to try to achieve his stated goals.
So when did he leave?
Huh?
When did he leave?
When did he live?
Yeah.
So he lives at this time.
Bilam, you talking about?
Bilam, yes.
The
now,
time of Moses.
Yes. So the Jewish people are traveling in the wilderness, the people of Moab, they're worried that they're right in the path of the Jewish people, and they're worried they're going to get the Jewish people are trouncing everyone, and they're in danger. They go and they hire Bilam to go curse the people. This is actually this upcoming week's parsha, and they go visit Bilam, and he says to them, "Okay, well, let me think about it. What's your offer?" He says, "We want you to come curse the Jewish people." And he says, let me think about it, let me talk to God about it. So he talks to the God at night, and the God says, well, no, don't go curse the people. Stay here, let them leave. Don't curse people. People are blessed and can't curse them. So he goes to them in the morning and says, sorry, guys, no can do. So they say, okay, they go back, and then they send up even a bigger team and more people, and they say, we'll offer you even more gold and just curse the people. He says, well, he asked God, just as long as I tell you not, but eventually he says, okay, I really, 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 really want to curse these people. And God says, okay, let's go curse the people. He goes, and he attempts to curse the people, and it doesn't work out. He's forced, God kind of forces his hand, makes him bless them. Three times he tries to curse the people, he unsuccessfully. He goes to different mountaintops. The whole story is described in the Torah. And instead of cursing them, he gives them these wonderful blessings. And at the end, he tells the leaders of Moab, by the way, you should know that there's a way to overcome the people because the God of the Jews hates promiscuity, and go try to find a way to get them to sin. and they take all the daughters of Moab, and they get them dressed really provocatively, and they go convince the Jews to sin, and they cause a tremendous catastrophe. That's the story. Either way, we meet Bilam, who is someone who has tremendous spiritual capacity, tremendous spiritual insight, knows the knowledge of God, one of the greatest prophets the world's ever seen. And what does he do with it? He kind of forces God's hand to go curse the people. God says, don't go curse him. But because he repeatedly asks again and again, God says, okay. And he's setting out to try to curse the Jewish people. Like, dude, this is the spiritual nation. Why are you going to curse them? And even when he's unsuccessful once, he says, I'll try it again. He's unsuccessful twice, he tries it a third time. He's unsuccessful a third time, he says, okay, fine, I'll give you the insight on how to undo them. Why is there such a divide between someone's spiritual capacity and the behavior that seems to be very loathsome? And in fact, we know more about his behavior where he had this encounter with his donkey. When we mentioned talk about the donkey, you know, his relationship with the donkey was more intimate than just a method of transportation.
That's the first time we hear bestiality, isn't it?
That I know of. And that seems to be something very reprehensible. So we see such a tremendous divide between someone's behavior and someone's knowledge, someone's understanding, someone's insight. And I think this is perhaps along the same lines of the Jewish people. They have these insights, they have these experiences, they have these understandings, these intellectual, at least, achievements. Yet the behavior seems to belie that. So I was thinking maybe, to put this all together, perhaps there's another idea here, and I think it's something that you guys all mentioned, or at least hinted towards, and that there's a difference between what we know and what we do. And what actually changes us, what actually transforms us as a person, as a people, as an individual, is not what we understand, rather what we do, how we behave, our actions, more than our insights. You know, someone could be an ethicist, study ethics, teach ethics, write about ethics, ponder ethics, and yet in their behavior can be in the most unethical behavior. Well, there's a separation between what I know and what I do, my insights and my actions. That seems to be possible. You know, we all familiar with the scandals of the people who sanctimoniously would get on top of, you know, would just lecture and preach about piety, yet in their personal lives they behaved in a very in a way that was antithetical to that. That's possible. Why? Because even though someone can have in their brain churning all this great ethics, but in their behavior, they behave in a different way. And who are they really? Are they what they know or what they do? Of course what they do. Because even if you have great achievements intellectually, unless you act upon them, they're not you. You are what you do. You could have tremendous insights, and that's great. And we meet Esau, Jacob's twin brother. We know that his head is buried in the same burial place as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the irony behind it is that Esau was someone who intellectually was no different than Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. However, he did not. The problem with Esau was not his understanding, rather his link between what he understood and what he behaved. And he was someone who was a great Torah scholar and a great ethicist in theory. But when it comes to behavior, you know, he's a terrible person.
Well, that's it. Actions speak louder than words.
That's not only that, actions don't speak louder. Actions are who you are, and words are, you know, they have value and they're important. But if it's not translated into action, it could be even injurious. Why do actions speak louder than words? Why are actions who we are? Why are actions more important? Why do actions change who we are much more than insights, experiences, intellectual understanding?
Because people see you as a person.
Forget about what people see. How do I transform myself? How come what my actions transform me, not my insights?
Because your insights are fleeting. It is your experience and what you do. And Bobby, we were just
Why?
You're a hypocrite. You know the right thing to do, and you do the opposite. You're just a hypocrite. You're not practicing what you preach.
So you're saying that kind of delegitimizes what you know if you don't behave in that?
Yeah.
It's not real.
Right.
But I'm sitting here listening to this intellectual conversation. That has to come first before I go out.
Let's say I agree with you. I think it's a very important point that if it's just action, not predicated on any understanding, well, then it could be your robot, you know?
Right.
A robot that does mitzvahs. Do we cheer for it? No, it's a robot. If it doesn't understand it, I think that's a good point. I think it's a very profound point that even your actions ought to be predicated. It means how does it start? It starts maybe from the intelligent, and then it should bleed into your behavior. But I was thinking maybe a fundamental idea perhaps is that actions are about your body. Insights, intellectuals, about your soul. Right? You can't quantify a thought, just like you can't quantify a soul. Like that, the entire things of the entire realm of understanding is linked to the soul. Perhaps even to the intelligence. However, the behavior, that's your body. In life, the body is what's flawed. Remember that in this relationship, the soul is fine. The soul influencing the body to change is the model that we have as Jews. Thus, what changes you is changing your body. Your soul is good to go to begin with. Now, perhaps we could say, you know, even going back to the red heifer. You know, the red heifer, there's no insight. It's just action. Perhaps the lesson behind that is to just remind us this idea that thoughts are great, understanding is great, intellectual is great, and most things we have to understand that. We should understand before we do. Some things are the opposite, or it's more experiential. We do before we understand, or we do and then we understand. But there is this idea of doing something entirely because you're doing it, not because you understand it at all. And that's a very powerful transformational idea. Just that it's possible for you to do something, and you're doing an action, and it's a mitzvah, and your body's engaged with it, and your mind is entirely not engaged with it. And I would even venture to say that Bilam, his understanding was unparalleled. No one had, maybe besides from Moses, no one had the same understanding. But what do we see? We see his behavior not being in line at all.
We see his behavior as being changeable.
As being what?
Changeable.
Because of course behavior is changeable.
He didn't want to curse, but he was coerced, is what I was thinking in my head, to do so.
Well, he wasn't coerced. He on his own accord, decided to go with them, but
yeah.
He kind of he pestered God, so to speak, he cajoled God into allowing him to do it.
So why would God allow himself to be cajoled?
Right.
Because that's the idea of free will. The idea is that someone is going to be allowed to do what they want to do ultimately, and God will allow people to do what, you know, almost entirely free. This free reign given almost entirely. There are some limitations on free will, but
so
almost entirely.
We all want to destroy the planet.
So that might be one of the limitations. We cannot fundamentally change the arena. However, in the arena, we can do almost entirely what we want. This is where pivoting into an entirely different discussion, the limitations of free will. You know, like God hardens the heart of Pharaoh. That's an example of limitation of free will. But either way, this point, I think, is a very important point. Let's talk about the Jewish people, right? Jewish people, they had the 10 plagues, and they had the manna, and they had the split of the sea, and they had the Mount Sinai. Did they have Torah?
No,
not yet.
They had oral.
They had but when they get that, after Moses comes down, Moses is the one who's giving them even the oral Torah as well. Now, so at the time, they had these insights, but they had no way to actualize it. They had no way for it to use that, to harness this insight and make it transformational for them. So all they had was this was like kind of unhinged insight that was not at all practical for them. That wasn't actionable for them. So what results? What do you have then? You have insight, but it's unfettered insight. It's ungrounded insight because you have no way to act upon that. And then if you have no way to act upon it, it's not going to change who you are. And I would even venture to say is that if you have tremendous insight, but you don't have action, it's likely that the insight will bring you astray. I was thinking that perhaps there's an argument to be made that Bilam, who had such tremendous insight, but he didn't have the action, then ironically the insight was worse off for him. And the Jewish people, that they had the tremendous insight, but they were worse off because they had no way to act upon it. Thus, there comes a point in time that the insight and the understanding and the intellectual aspect of it becomes injurious to the person, which to me was a mind-blowing idea. How it's possible to have an insight that if you're not going to implement it, it's going to be bad for you. So ironically, it's often or potentially better off, you're better off not knowing. Had Bilam been a regular Joe Schmo, had he not had a prophecy and these tremendous insights, he would have been better off because he wouldn't have been as evil, which is mind-blowing. And the Jewish people, if they didn't have those insights, well, maybe they wouldn't have had stooped so low. Because an insight is a demand for action. And thus, if it's an unfulfilled understanding, it's going to be fulfilled in another way. Where someone perhaps thinks, oh, look at my brilliance, my genius, and then God kind of falls out of the question, and behavior that can be very reprehensible can result. I think that it's slightly different,
yeah.
But I think it's could be a parallel. We do find a statement in the Talmud, which I think to me is a validation of this idea, where it says about the Torah. It says, Torah, Zacha nasa lo samachayim, lo zacha nasa lo samamavas. It says, if someone merited, then the Torah becomes an elixir of life. However, if someone does not merit, it becomes a potion of death. Well, what is the Torah? It's a potion, right? It's a medicine. It's an elixir. However, what you do with it will determine if it's very good for you or if it's very bad for you. Well, how could Torah be bad? How could Torah be bad?
You know when it's good and not doing it.
So I was saying maybe that's what it means. Maybe if someone has the insight but doesn't act upon it, if it doesn't change who you are, well, then it's bad for you, which is mind-blowing. How could Torah be bad for you? It could potentially be bad for you. Because that is a reflection of his character.
Absolutely.
His character was so perverted and so deterministic in his own way of doing things and so full of hatred to the Jewish people that he says, I'm going to try and try and try.
Yeah, if his insight matched up with his motive and actions, he wouldn't have gone back and asked again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he look at the tents and say...
Well, that's afterwards. Look at the tents, they gave him a blessing. Matobo lach Yaakov, how beautiful are your tents... Right, he gives three blessings, and these blessings, by the way, are we look at Bilam as someone who he was forced into the blessings. He was handcuffed, but these he gives descriptions of the people. It means he defines our nation very, very well, and we know that's part of our prayer, Matov Alech Yaakov. Right, that's part of the Torah because he was a great intellectual and. Great insight, and he was forced into it against his will, but he captured the greatness of the people. He captured the core of the nation. Pretty remarkable. I have some more ideas here. Go ahead.
Isn't he killed later in one of the
Yes,
cows?
yes. Pinchas actually killed him.
I think Joshua actually tells him to go look for him. Am I wrong?
Oh, they found him. They found him. They found him. They got him. Oh, yeah. They got him and actually killed his donkey as well. And the verse tells us they kill his donkey, and this is, which is very, very interesting. Why, first of all, who cares if they kill the donkey? But why would they do that?
Because of the relationship.
So what? Yep. Wasn't that the donkey's innocent?
Because he had taught, and plus, I didn't know that he had.
He was a witness.
Well, the whole donkey thing could have been a propaganda after the fact. Right?
Well, okay, so even if it is, so what's the lesson?
The donkey represents
physicality. Yeah, but okay, fine. But why kill a donkey and why tell us about it? Who cares about the donkey? I mean, the donkey sees if it's important in the narrative, but why tell us that? Like, who cares? So what? If, maybe they killed someone else's horse. You know, battle's brutal. War is not fun. War is unpleasant. You know, a lot animals die as well. Innocent animals. But why tell us about it?
Well, wasn't it because he talked and told his master what he was doing wrong?
So the Talmud says like this. This is an incredible idea, I think. The Talmud says is that this donkey was a personification of Bilaam's shame. Because you know that the donkey kind of stood him up.
Yeah.
And he had nothing to say. He had nothing to say to the donkey. And if this donkey was allowed to live, it would be a permanent shrine to Bilaam's failures. Now, Bilaam was a bad guy. However, the Torah does not punish punitively. It does not go over the top in punishment. Thus, he got his punishment. He was executed. But the lasting visualization of his shame was also removed from the world. Which is incredible to think about the sensitivity that the Torah has and the Jewish people are taught to have with regards to not doing more. You know, not just piling it on. And even to the worst enemies of the Jewish people. Even to the most reprehensible characters in Jewish life. Which is, to me, incredible. Like, we're so insensitive to someone who set out, and he was successful in really harming the Jewish people.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly there, are you saying to kill the donkey was actually showing a kindness to Bill?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, quick story here. Story time. The Talmud talks about honoring parents. And a very, very interesting, very long, give a whole class about honoring parents. But either way, it gives a story or asks a question. And the question is, how far does someone need to honor their parents? To what extent? What's the nth degree of the requirement of honoring parents? It says that the requirement extends as far as this Gentile who lived in Ashkelon, how he did, his name is Tamar ben Asina. And he is the example of how far someone needs to be in honoring their parents. Well, what's the story? The story is that the rabbis at the time, he's non-Jewish, rabbis at the time, they needed, he had stones, precious stones, and the rabbis were looking for a stone that was missing from the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. You know, had stones, so they came to him. He was going to be someone they were going to buy a stone from. He says, yeah, I got the right stone. And he goes, and he's looking for the key to his vault, and he finds that his dad, who is staying by him, is sleeping on a pillow, and under the pillow is the key. And the key is the key that opens the vault. And he tells the people, sorry, I can't help you. I cannot wake up my dad from his nap, even if it means losing, forfeiting a lot of money. I'm sorry, I can't help you. And they went over to the next stone deal, and he lost out on the deal. And that is how far someone needs to go to honor parents, even if it means forfeiting a lot of money. That's what the Talmud says. Now, the story continues that in merit of his tremendous sacrifice that he did for honoring his parents, honoring his dad, Dama ben Asina the Gentile merited that in his flock a red heifer was born. And because the red heifer was born, the rabbis came back, and they said that we want to buy the red heifer. We need as many red heifers as we get our hands on. And he says, you know what? I'll sell it to you, but I'm only going to sell it to you for the amount of money that I would have made in profit for the original deal, because I recognize that this was given to me in merit of me forfeiting that other deal. That's the story. And of course, there's a few questions. I think question number one is, okay, the Talmud has a question. How far does somebody need to extend? How far are the requirements of honoring parents? So what does it do? It says, you know what? We found a story about a Gentile. Wait a minute, Gentile. There's no Jews. There's no Jews who demonstrated great, you know, success in honoring parents. You know, there's not a single Jew out there like this. We have to go to a Gentile. He's the only example of someone who did a sacrifice to honor his father or his mother. This is the only example we could find. They can't find an example of a Jew. Or, you know, we have to bring the story. Like, why would you do that? Is that a good question, guys? You want to read? It's a good question. Okay, good. Next question is, he gets a reward. We find out the epilogue of the story. Dama ben Asina, the Gentile who excelled in honoring parents from Ashkelon, he received a reward. What was his reward? Red heifer. And what did he do? He sold the red heifer for the same amount of money he would have made had the deal gone through. So not only is the Talmud telling us that this was his reward, he even recognizes that was his reward. Why would this be the reward? Why would the reward for honoring parents, honoring your dad, honoring your father, be receiving a red heifer? Why not, I don't know, receiving a American pharaoh, right? His horse, right? His horse was very valuable. Why red heifer? So my thought was, the lesson perhaps is like this. So I'll start with the first question. Gentile, right? What does Gentile mean? He has no Torah. Thus, what's he governed by? His own reason. His own intelligence. And you know what? His own intelligence can very easily deduce that you should honor your parents. Why is that? Because it makes a lot of sense. It's very logical. Your parents do so much for you. They give you so much. They worry for you. They care for you. They clothe you. They feed you. They worry for you, and they stay up at night for you, and they change dirty diapers, and they pay for tuition, and go to soccer practice. They do so much for you. It only makes sense to honor them back when, you know, once you come of age. And you know what? This is something that's not relegated to Jews alone. It makes sense. It could be everyone. Well, we have a Torah. We have a mitzvah, you know, but the Gentiles as well. And perhaps what the Talmud is saying is that this is something that even Gentiles fulfill. And you know what? We find that in the Torah itself, Esau was someone who excelled at honoring his father. And in fact, in this one mitzvah, he was even better than Jacob. Which was remarkable. How could Esau be better than Jacob? But the answer is, well, this something makes sense. This was not something that you need to have instruction to understand. It's something that everyone could fulfill, and it made sense to everyone. However, what's his reward? His reward is the mitzvah that makes the least sense. His reward is the mitzvah that no matter how much you try to understand, no matter how far you stretch your brain, no matter how many mental gyrations you make, you cannot understand it. That's the reward. Doesn't make any sense. It seems to be the exact opposite. The reward should be commensurate. The reward should be something that also makes sense. Why would the reward be something that makes no sense to us, at least? Good question, huh? So I was thinking here, another idea here, guys. Perhaps what the Torah is telling us, or what this story is telling us, is that even a mitzvah, like honoring parents, that a Gentile could deduce on their own. You don't need Torah for it. However, the reason why we ought to do it is the same reason why we do red heifer. At the core of why we do mitzvahs is because God told us to do it. It doesn't matter if it makes the most sense, it makes the least sense, the reason is the same. The reason why we do both mitzvahs is the same. Why? Because God tells us. If we have, and perhaps that's the lesson. The lesson is that specifically in the area where we're most likely to attribute our own understanding, we get reminded that no, this is about doing it solely because God wants you to do it. And I think this could potentially be a transformational idea. When we honor our parents, why are we doing it? So it could be that we're doing it for the same reason Dhamma Vinasena did it, the Gentile. Because it makes sense, it's rational, it's reasonable. That could be the reason why we do it. However, there's a much higher, much greater mitzvah that we could have when we do it, not because it makes sense to us, we're doing it because we're instructed to by God. Thus, it elevates the mitzvah from being a mitzvah that we're doing it because it makes sense to us, and we're saying, no, we're doing it because red heifer makes sense to God. And I was thinking that perhaps this we could even extend this mitzvah to other areas, that or this insight to other areas, that even when we do kindness, well, why are you doing kindness? You could do kindness because you help another. You want to help another person. Makes sense, interdependency. You know, that's the reason why you could do kindness. Or you can say, I'm doing kindness because it's the mitzvah of the Torah, because God told me to do it. And that elevates the activity from being something that you're doing perhaps because it made sense, and you're doing it because of what God tells you. And that's perhaps even more transformational. Now, I have some more ideas, but I don't want to burden you guys with so many ideas. But let's just try to recap here just some of just the highlights of what we did mention. You know, we brought, I guess, three different... we'll start off with red heifer. Red heifer, I think we'd have at least three or four ideas. We said, number one, it proves the divinity of the Torah in a certain capacity. Number two, it teaches us about reliance on God. It's very important to know that you do things sometimes because you do them, and you just do them, and you buy flowers, and you do the red heifer, and you just do it. You don't know, and you have to learn to be okay with that. Additionally, we saw Bilam and the Jewish people, and we see people that have tremendous insights, and that doesn't do it for them. Why? Because the actions are transformational. And if Bilam didn't have actions to support, to back his tremendous intellectual capacities, well, then it wouldn't change him. And if the Jewish people did not have a Torah to actualize their understanding, well, it wouldn't change them. Red heifer is something that we do solely out of action. It does change us. We don't understand it, but it is representative of what maybe perhaps all mitzvahs ought to look like. That there is the action element that is going to be what's going to change who we are. And that's, you know, we find that there were several mitzvahs that were given to us before the Torah, before Mount Sinai. If you read the Exodus story, the first place that they went to was a place called Marah. That's where the water was bitter, and then Moses had to drop the wood into the water to make it sweet. And if you read the verses very clearly, it says that there they got Torah, or there they got mitzvahs. Sham sam lo chok v'sham nisahu. The verse says, means there they received a chok. There, what's a chok? Chok means a mitzvah that we don't understand. Which chok did they receive? They received the mitzvah of the red heifer. It seems like even before they got the Torah, they were warned. You should know that there's this idea of doing something that you don't understand, action above insight. Rely on God, don't rely on yourself. I think that this is something which is such a core idea to Torah at large that it had to come even before Torah itself. It had to be like a precursor, a prologue to Torah. It has to be the law of the red heifer. Why? Because it's preparing the Jewish people. Listen, you're about to get the Torah. You're about to have tremendous insights. You're about to have a lot of reasonings. You should know that its action is even more important. And I'm going to give you a mitzvah that makes only sense to God. It's only for us about action. And I'm going to give you that before the Torah to remind you about the importance of this mitzvah of a red heifer and the insight of the action above reason. I think in conclusion, I think, you know, what does this mean for us? You know, we study a lot of Torah every Sunday. We have a lot of mitzvahs that we talk about. We have a lot of character improvement we talk about. We have history that we talk about. You know, and it's very enlightening, I hope. It's enlightening for me. I hope it's enlightening for everyone. You know, we learn things. We learn ideas. And this is primarily about, you know, incorporating ideas into our mind and into our understanding. But it's important for us for the rest of the week, you know, think about how we could actually use this to become a better person, how we could translate this into action. If we just take the insight and we use it either to stimulate our intelligence or it's interesting or because it's informative or because we want to learn about it, but we say we're not going to act upon it, we're not going to try to glean some sort of actionable activity, behavior out of this insight, are we really better off than the Jewish people when they sin to the golden calf? Are we really ensuring that we're not going to follow the same path? Are we really any better than Bilaam, who said, I have my insight, I have my ethics, I have my understanding, and my behavior is not going to be at all impacted by that? I don't know. I think it's an indictment on us if we don't try to act upon what we learn here, but not only here, in any part of our lives. You know, when we do not actually live and practice about what we learn, well then, what good is the learning that we do? The Jewish people, Bilaam, they had all the learning. You know, they had Mount Sinai. What could be a more instructive? What could be a greater experience to a human? Nothing. Yet, how did they behave? Because what was the link? You know, what was the missing link that made this possible? You know, they did not act upon it. Well, truth is, they didn't have Torah. They didn't know perhaps what to act upon it. But at least it should serve a warning for us that if we do not act upon what we know, we're no better off. And we're also at risk of having behavior that belies our understanding. So that's the call to action. The call to action is that we have to take the lesson of the red heifer, take the lesson of Bilaam, take the lesson of the Jewish people, and try to also, in our lives, in our insights, to try to find actionable activities that we could use to make sure that we behave, we act in a way that is not in conflict, that is congruent to what we know and to what we learn. And if we do that, indeed, we will be transformed. That's where the change lies. Not in 10 to 12 or 10 to 11:30, sometimes I go over time, I apologize. At 10 to 11:30 on Sundays, or when we're in synagogue, or reading a book about self-help, or when we're studying the Torah, it's about what we do with that and how we actually translate that into action. When we do that, right, when we actually do the rest of the process, then we see the change. And then we can look back and see how we actually grew in a tangible, real way that's going to last. That's a call to action. We could all do it. I have full faith in everyone, myself included. We could do it. And let this be a clarion call for not only this class, not only for this insight, but to other insights, other classes. You know, we're going to talk about other very important things. We have a class. I don't remember. Next week, no class. But the following week, I don't know if it's the following week, but we have a class scheduled on proper speech. How to speak nice to other people, how to not be gossipy, how to not speak lashon hara. That's something that's everyday life, you know. And someone's a gossip monger, well, they're, no one likes that. And that's something that we all, you know, we're very verbal. We're a very verbal and social species. So this is something that most people have struggled with. We'll learn all about it. We'll learn all the laws, learn all the ideas behind it. Will it matter? It might if we behave, if we change our behavior, but maybe it will, maybe it won't. It's up to us. And no one could force you to change. No one could just download into your brain activity, you know. That is up to us. It's up to us. We could do it. Anyhow, thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If there's any questions, no questions, great. We got all the answers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you all for coming and listening.